I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a favorite poem some new readers and listeners. I say listeners because all the Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today I'm joined here in Philadelphia in Studio 111 at the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing by Jessica Lowenthal, a teacher and poet, author of As If Interning, and director of the Kelly Writers House, and by Lynn Din, the Saigon-born poet whose most recent book of poems is Jam Alerts, and by Randall Couch, a poet, critic, administrator, and teacher of poetry and poetics at Arcadia University. Welcome, all of you, to Poem Talk, and thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Al. Hi. Great to be here.
Our poem today is Adrienne Rich's short lyric called Wait, W-A-I-T. And before we begin to talk about it, let's have a listen. Our recording was made in April 2005 during Rich's visit here to the Writer's House. So here now is Adrienne Rich reading Wait.
In paradise, the desert wind is rising. Third thought, in hell there are no thoughts, is of earth. Sand screams against your government-issued tent. Hell's noise in your nostrils. Crawl into your earshell. Wrap yourself in no thought. Wait, no place for the little lyric wedding ring glint, the reason why on earth they never told you.
Let me ask first what you think the title of the poem means, and this is another way of asking you to say generally what you think the poem is about.
Well, the title is repeated in a moment in the poem, the wrap yourself in no thought, wait. So it seems to be a directive of some kind that appears in the poem, although I don't know what that wait in the middle of the poem means.
Randall, ideas? What's being waited for? Who's waiting and what's being waited for?
Change.
Change?
Political change.
Oh, so you're going big on this. Lynn, can we be a little more narrative about this?
Well,
if this were a short story, what would it say? You know, what would it be
about?
I just
see it as, you know, happiness and desire suspended. You know, the soldier has to sacrifice now in hope of some, you know, future fulfillment.
I like to think of this title as referring to sitting around waiting in a tent during a sandstorm. There's a lot of waiting.
And Rich also said that she wrote this poem on the eve of the actual invasion, so there was a massed force of people in advance of the actual
poem,
word to go.
This is a poem not about the war that hadn't started yet, but about waiting for it to start.
Exactly.
Who is being... So there is someone being addressed. Lynn has said he. I think it might be a she. It might be a woman soldier. I'm not sure why I say that, but someone is being addressed, presumably a soldier. Okay, so let's get to this proverb. In paradise, every third thought is of earth. It's interlineated so that there are two of Rich's own lines in between italicized lines, three of them, that are quoted from a proverb. I know, Randall, that you've found the source of this. Can you tell us a little bit about it and then tell us what you think it means?
Sure. The source of the line is from a poem by Stanley Moss, which was published in the American Poetry Review in November, December of 2002. It's a long poem, and it comes right at the end. Death, I think you take your greatest pleasure in watching us murdering in great numbers in ways even you have not planned. They say in paradise every third thought is of earth and a woman with a child at her breast. And that's the way he ends the poem. The opening of Rich's poem, Wait, interlineates that and interrupts it with two other lines. After those six lines, the poem converges again, and it's only one stream of voice. And it seems to me one reading is that interlineation creates in the reader's kind of mental theater two voices, not really fully characterized speakers, but two different sources of sound that then converge in a kind of chorus. So it's a strategy to counter, you know, what's the great risk of a political poem is that it's like one isolated individual whining about something.
Well, that's great, and I think it helps us understand why she needed this short poem to have, at least at the beginning, two voices. What do you think the italicized section of the poem actually means? What would be a translation of it?
I think it means even in paradise we have responsibility toward political action, or we have responsibility toward the things of the earth, that a heavenly state or a paradisiac state doesn't mean that we leave aside our earthly concern.
And I think it's important to remember here in terms of context that, you know, there were a lot of media repetitions of the idea that there are some biblical scholars who place the location of the Garden of Eden in the marshlands in the southeast of Iraq. And that was said a lot during this time. So there's some irony here, too, about the person in the poem being situated in paradise in addition to the heavenly idea.
In paradise, the desert wind is rising. Third thought, in hell there are no thoughts, is of earth.
If in hell there are no thoughts, in this poem, she says it explicitly, then is it being implied that in paradise there are thoughts? I think it is. At least every third thought is of earth. So is it that the state of not thinking is hell? And if your answer to that question is yes, then why is she recommending to the person she's speaking to in this poem that he or she wrap him or herself in no thought? One would think that would be a negative state.
Well, because he's in hell.
Already.
The soldier is literally being placed in hell, and, you know, he's forced to remove thoughts from his head because nothing makes sense, in a sense. You know, so that's why wrap yourself in no thought. Wait, no place for the little lyric. You know, the normality, the supposed normality that we all entitled to.
In paradise, the desert wind is rising. Third thought, in hell there are no thoughts, is of earth.
This is a poem that, in the simplest sense, beautifully, although briefly, reproduces the condition of being in a tent, a government-issued tent, hell's noise. Any of us who've been in a very, very loud place, you can't think, can't hear yourself think. And this poem, which is itself a little lyric, this poem is, in some sense, an answer, a thought in response to the loud noise of no thought.
I'd like to follow up on that. I think that there's an interesting little clue here in terms of strategies about the political poem in the missing hyphen.
Mm-hmm.
Notice lower in the poem where she has compound adjectives before the noun, she conventionally uses the hyphen, as in wedding ring glint. At the end of the line, screams against your government-issued tent, she omits the hyphen to sort of emphasize that line break. And I would suggest that one of the functions of that is to create a situation where the sand, that is nature, is seeming to resist the policy that this soldier represents. In other words, it's a way to invoke the pathetic fallacy here, that nature basically is resisting this war mightily.
Crawl into your ear shell. Wrap yourself in no thought. Wait, no place for the little lyric wedding ring glint, the reason why on earth they never told you.
Let's look at the end of the poem, because I think we are going to disagree about this. The soldier is asked to wrap him or herself in no thought and to wait. And then this assertion, no place for the little lyric, wedding ring glint, the reason why on earth they never told you. Let me ask first, all of you, who is they? Who is it that's not telling the soldier something?
They are the deciders.
The soldier to war?
Yes,
exactly.
Of course.
Okay, they.
Sure,
and they,
government.
And it depends on how far you want to go with that. I mean, it could be the whole cultural chain of socialization, but I think, you know, immediately the government policy, but it could be, you know, the parents who told you to, you know, be good and follow orders. And
that's what I find so odd about the wedding ring glint is that Rich is so interested in thinking about marriage as an institution that's a problem. And yet in this poem, that seems to be the source of solace or the thing that allows
the
soldier.
Oh, I disagree. The implication of your comment is that this is not as radical a poem as other poems earlier, let's say. But I think that when the soldier, for one reason or another, is caused to look at his or her wedding ring, he or she is enacting the personal as the political, which is so important to Rich's poems of the 1970s, and is thinking that love is the one thing that he or she has some control over. You can't take the wedding ring off my finger. You could blow it off, I suppose, but there it is. And love is the reason why, that this, whatever it is that I see in this glint of this wedding ring, I am reminded that the sun of Iraq is glinting on this wedding ring, and this is the most powerful thing that I have. It's not simply sort of easy liberal solace, think about whom you love and you'll get through this horrible war scene. But in fact, that's the very reason why they didn't tell you. So I repeat my question, what is it? I mean, how would you spell out what it is that they didn't tell you?
Well, I mean, one reading of the poem is that what they didn't tell him or her is the reason why they're about to kill a lot of people and have to endure this raging sandstorm in a remote place and suffer.
Does this poem, or does a political poem like this in general, make you feel, the three of you, more or less confident that poetry is good at expressing political thoughts or feelings?
I'm not sure you can generalize about that. I think that the writing political poems has opportunities and risks, and you adopt strategies to cope with the risks. I think this one has mixed success, in my view.
I mean, this is a lifelong project for Rich, you know, meditating on war. So to look at this single poem and say whether it works or not is kind of unfair, because this is, you know, this is her investigation into, you know, the ethics and the meanings of war and just of living and of what does it mean to be gullible and to be used.
Is it possible that we don't know how to talk about this poem? I mean, is it possible that that there's an allure to talking about this poem thematically that's going to miss what's so good about it?
I think that's quite possible.
Would you state that as adamantly and radically as this? It's not really important that the poem is about Iraq or this particular war, but the strategies and devices used to create this lyric are what will be interesting.
Absolutely. To me, that's the principal interest of the poem, is how does she handle this problem of writing a good political poem?
So Lynn and Jessica, isn't Randall being a little apolitical about this? He's being a formalist, isn't he? What kind of conversation takes place between you, not just about this poem, but about poetry in general? How do we negotiate this discussion?
I don't think Randall and I are far apart on this.
No.
So if this is a poem where lyric is a problem or an issue, the first half is a demonstration of that problem or a working out of that problem. And the multivocal nature of the first half is in itself a weird thing for lyric. If a lyric is an overheard utterance or a singular speaker or a moment of distillation or however it is that we individually take the lyric, and if it's a problem or a question or a working out of lyric, that first half is a demonstration of some kind of possibilities
right.
in the lyric or directions in the lyric or problems of the lyric.
Sand screams against your government-issued tent, hell's noise in your nostrils.
As a sophomore in college, I asked what was called a sophomore question to my poetry teacher. I asked him, what is great poetry? And he said, gave me a great answer, which I remember. He said, great poetry is a poem that somehow acknowledges that it is a poem, or that it is in the act of finding what will suffice to be a poem, to borrow a little bit from Wallace Stevens there. Mm-hmm. Is this a poem? I'm not asking you whether it's a great poem. Is this a poem that in several ways indicates its status and its struggle as a poem, trying to figure out what a poem can do, for instance, in relation to war?
I think
so.
And
if so, where are the signals of that?
Having the italics, having a source text other than the poem text, indicates we're in a field, a textual field.
Intertextuality.
Intertextuality, yes.
That's one.
Second is the polyvocality of interlacing the opening lines.
Right, another?
Third is the hyphenation absence and emphasis on the line break, which separates government issued into government.
And, of course, finally, the reference to the little lyric at the end of the poem. Lynn?
Yeah. And also her absence of punctuations in most lines, and also her very skillful use of the vowel, certain vowel sequences.
Give us some examples of how that works.
Well, little lyric, wedding ring, glint, you know, the eye.
The short eye.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And that creates a sense of self-consciousness. This is a wrought expression as opposed to simply what's on her mind about the war.
And when you see it on the page as well, there's also some interesting expanded spacing between words resonating with the title weight. It's like she's, again, enacting this frustration of postponing the expected.
Ah, you've answered a question I haven't asked yet, which is, going back to the title, Wait, if we were simply thinking of this poem in the basic thematic way, it would be a poem having to do with waiting, waiting for war to start, waiting in your tent for the sandstorm to end. But now we're talking about wait in a different way, in a poetics sort of way. So how would you restate that? Wait means, in a meta-poetic sense, wait means wait for what?
Closure.
Waiting for closure.
So invoking a kind of suspension. Interestingly, this poem does, though, move toward a fairly firm closure at the end, I think. Why do we have that sense, I wonder? Why does it feel like a closure?
I don't have that sense.
You don't?
I have a sense of openness, in a political sense, radical openness. You can't help, I'll speak for myself, I can't help end this poem without thinking, what is it that they didn't tell you? And, of course, that causes me to have the political thought that didn't get explicitly into the poem. They didn't tell you that this was the reason that you've gone to war. They didn't tell you that this is the reason you'll never see your loved one again.
Absolutely, thematically. I was speaking of closure poetically or technically. It feels to me like it closes with a click, and I don't expect another line.
Is that bad?
I don't think it's bad or good. It's traditional, and given what we were saying earlier about the sort of poetic experiments and strategies in the poem, it's a little surprising given the title Wait and what we've said about waiting and suspension.
Wait, no place for the little lyric wedding ring glint.
All across the 20th century, modern and modernist poets said in one way or other, those who were interested in political issues and social issues, there weren't too many of them, but those that were interested said, if the poem is going to be open formally, then its thematics has to be open, because you create a conservative poem saying radical things. If you write a poem about the Depression, about hobos standing in the food line, a bread line, it's a been-there-done-that poem that's not open in any sense formally, then it becomes a conservative poem about a radical topic. Is this a poem that falls into a little bit of that trouble? And I ask the question, asking you to keep in mind that that is the charge that was made against Rich when she turned to political poetry after her formalist beginnings. Do you think that this poem can revive such a charge? I don't, but I wonder if you do.
No, I don't think so, because I think there's more ambivalence here. You know,
in the sense, her part, on the speaker's part.
On her part,
part,
yeah, yes. Which I see as a philosophical in poem rather than a war poem, you know. So I think she's less likely to be charged of being didactic or, you know, bombastic or whatever.
So we don't even agree what all of this poem means, so I think that it's clear on that level that it's not a closed poem. It's not hobos standing in a bread line, easy to understand, read, easy to understand what the message is.
Yeah, and the fact that the ending moves toward a kind of closure doesn't mean that the other techniques in the poem are similarly conservative either.
So I just want to comment too, you know, the proximity of paradise to wait made me think of Waiting for Godot, you know, it's like a kind of...
a modernist kind of waiting for something that's not going to come.
Redemption,
and, and in Beckett or Ashbery, you often get a message that's going to be delivered and isn't, or a message in Ashbery that's delivered and you open up the message and it doesn't say anything, or the speaker doesn't give you the message that's been received. If you apply that message never received to politics, to contemporary postmodern politics, global politics, you get the message never received by the poet. Why are we at war?
Reading the poem now, particularly a strong overtone here, is because none of the goals for which this war was launched seem to have been realized. So we're also waiting for the redemption, the justification, the rationale.
We're waiting for paradise in both,
exactly,
in both the unironic and the ironic sense. Heaven can
wait.
Before we get to the Gathering Paradise segment of our show, let me ask each of you to offer a final word on this poem, or maybe something more on what you get from it. Jessica, final thought?
Yeah, I don't think of Rich as a poet who challenges the use value of lyric. Like, lyric seems to be something that has political efficacy, that does something. This poem, though, seems to work with the lyric as something that might have some problems. That moment, little lyric, wedding ring glint. And that really interests me, that poetry is not quite indicted here, but included in what they
Haven't been talking about this poem itself an instance of the little lyric that's problematic?
I think it is.
Interesting.
I think it is.
Interesting. Lynn, your final thought?
I like her blurring of the, you know, the human, the individual body and the earth as a body. You know, this is a strategy she uses over and over again. So an assault on the single bodies and also an assault on the earth and vice versa. And also like the sadness and the resignation of, you know, the fact that all we have is the little lyric and is all we can look forward to. And, you know, many people don't even get that. So I like the sadness in that.
Beautiful. Randall, final thought?
Well, recurring to your earlier question about what Jessica called the use value of political poems, I think what interests me the most in this poem is the strategies that Rich attempts to employ to create a work that that will stand up aesthetically in spite, so to speak, of the political use to which it's trying to be put.
We like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of gathering paradise, a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good, to extol, hail, puff up, or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. So, Jessica, can you gather a little paradise for us?
Sure. Our director and editor, or our sound engineer, Steve McLaughlin, runs a series here at the Writer's House called Machine, based around digital literatures. And he's just introduced me to an artist named Paul Notzold, who has an ongoing interactive public art installation piece called Textual Healing. That's TXTUAL. And basically, what this artist does is project empty text bubbles, like from cartoons, onto buildings, in galleries, and then he posts a phone number and invites people to text in their messages. So it's this great example of, I think, our typewriter, like a tab stop, a new way of using text that is creating, I think, formal changes.
That's really neat.
Thank you.
It's fun.
Randall, you're gathering paradise?
I have some things from the amazing Peruvian poet Cesar Vallejo. Clayton Eshelman has just published from University of California Press his translations of the collected poems after many decades of work. I want to read a little bit from one poem, however, by a different translator, Rebecca Seiferly. This is from poem 36 from Vallejo's second book, Trilce. Are you there, Venus de Milo? You pretend to be one-handed, barely sprouting deep within the complete arms of existence. Of this existence, that yet and yet perennials perfection. And then at the end, he says, refuse all of you to lay plans in harmony's doubled certainty. Truly refuse the symmetry. Mediate the conflict of the points that dispute among the most ruttish of the just and leap through the eye of a needle.
Well, that's all the hobos in a breadline we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writers House at the University of Pennsylvania, and the Poetry Foundation of Chicago, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests Lynn Dinh, Jessica Lowenthal, and Randall Couch, and to my co-producer Mark Lindsay, and Poem Talk's assistant director and editor Steve McLaughlin, with special help from Curtis Fox. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for another Poem Talk.